Katy Perry and a tune called Smile, which is what I'm doing right now because I've been joined by an old friend. I told you at the start of the show I'd be in conversation with Wayne Duncan. Wayne, it feels like a conversation with an old friend. We've been, well, since Life and Style Media has been on the North Coast extant for over 20 years, and right at the beginning, you pretty much at the beginning were part of the local scene in terms of the ocean, because no one that at that time that I could identify knew more about the sea than you. And you were a surfing dude, a fisherman, a diver, a spear fisherman, and you had this phenomenal ability to write about it. And I used to love those stories. And you wrote for us for many years. But let's go back and start at the beginning. Where did you grow up?
Yeah, thanks, Dave. Thanks for having me on the show. So actually, I was born in Joburg.
Ah.
I'm an old Joburg boy. And I went to Edenvale High School, and I studied at WITS, Marketing and Business. But always had a love for the ocean. So all our holidays, school holidays and everything else, it was at the coast. And my first job, I was 16 years old, I worked as an entertainment manager at the Breakers Hotel because we'd been there so many times, we knew the staff, you know. And I always knew that I wanted to move to the coast. And in my third years of study, we had to do a practical year. And so I wanted to come to the coast. So I came and did my practical here. Worked for all companies with Rob Hopkins called Mini Home Ads. And they started a courier company. Yeah, so I moved here and did my practical year. And then just stayed, which was all part of the plan.
You developed a deep love for the sea and everything nautical.
Yeah.
Was that something that you developed on your holidays, or did that come once you moved down here?
I think it was just kind of the way my gran explained it, is that it was in my DNA. So I remember she once looked at me and she said, "My boy, you don't have blood running through your veins, you've got salt water." So just something I loved. I actually grew up, my gran and grandpa were managers of a dam next to Hartbeespoort, Buffelspoort Dam. So all my school holidays when I was really young were on the dam. I learned to fish and row and canoe, and always had a love for water and for dams and the ocean.
I see you've reconnected with that love of late because your social media pages are full of enormous carp. Enormous, the biggest carp I've ever seen. So clearly that's something, and we'll get into that a little later.
Yeah.
But the ocean in the beginning, and yes. I'm going back now 20 yes. years and beyond that, or to that period of time, you were considered among the very finest at the time.
Yeah.
In terms of your, particularly your ability to read the sea and to teach people about the fine art of fishing from under the water, not on top of the water, spearfishing.
Spearfishing,
that
yeah.
is an awesome, and I wanted to ask you more about that because it's fascinated me. I mean, I've tried to hold my breath from time to time with goggles or, you know, and a snorkel just to look at the fish, and you know, after a very short space of time, I've got a surface to breathe. When you're down hunting,
yeah.
you've got to be a hell of a lot more oxygenated than that. Tell us about the technique.
Yeah, it was really something that I had to, you know, build up to. So when I was living here at the coast, I joined the Mshlali Angling Club. So it was a rock and surf club. And we were fishing from the beach. And around that time, I learned to surf as well. So I took a year off. This around about this time when we met, Dave. So what I did is I took a year after studying, and I had a music school. So I just gave guitar lessons.
That's right. You're a musician as well.
Yeah.
Many strings to the bow.
So actually, I remember sitting in your lounge and us playing guitar together when we first got together to write for the magazine. You're quite a mean guitarist yourself. I was blown away.
Like a blues, we should get like together again.
Master. How I couldn't
about
believe
that?
It.
Let's reunite after 20 years. Jeez. Do a little show here.
Yeah. No, you. I remember it making an impression on me. I remember thinking I need to up my guitar game. So, you know, I used to be fishing at places like Tiffany's Beach, and I'd be on the beach and I'd see these spear fishermen come in and they'd have these massive fish. And I remember thinking, I mean, that's impressive. But not the thought of swimming all the way out there, kilometer out to sea, and finding a fish and shooting it just seemed too, you know, too difficult. I didn't think it was something that I'd be able to do. But I watched these guys from a distance. And when I was surfing, I met Chris Coates. And Chris Coates, in his own right, is a very, very good diver. So Chris and Warren Blackmore, some local guys, they took me under the wing, and they started taking me for some dives. And that's how I got into it. And I built up to it. I had to get fitter. I had to start running. And they taught me
that. Is that the essence of it? The fitter you are, the more you can hold your breath. Is that the technique?
So you have to be really, really fit, because you swim out with gear and you're out for a long time. So there's a fitness component. But you can be as fit as a fiddle if you don't know how to breathe up, so that you can go down. You know, so you develop those techniques. And so you have to learn how to breathe while you're diving to oxygenate your blood so that you don't feel out of breath. You have to learn how to slow your heartbeat down, relax, find the spot where you want to go. And you actually breathe up. You compact your lungs with air and then slowly drift down, conserving. And so you have to learn those techniques. And it's quite a learning curve.
The same techniques that free diving, I would imagine, teaches.
Very similar. Conserving your energy, keeping your oxygen levels high, staying calm. There's some exercises you can do to increase your lung capacity. So, you know, I'd lie in the bath every night and hold my breath and time it and try different compression techniques in your lungs and, you know, get fitter. And as time went on, I could dive deeper and deeper. And then eventually, once you master those techniques, you're A for a way, yeah.
And does it stay with you for life, or is it something that you use it or lose it, sort of thing?
I think the best way to answer that is to say I'm not quite as fit as I was.
Do you still dive?
I don't dive much anymore. You know, as you get older and you're working more and everything else, I found that I have less time to do the things that I enjoy. And the things I enjoy the most now are fishing and surfing. So I mainly do fishing, and I'm not diving anymore.
What was the biggest fish you ever shot?
Oh, jeez. It would be a sailfish, about a 36 kilogram sailfish. They're very long, so it's also a big, impressive fish. But it's a horrible fish to shoot because you feel terrible afterwards, because they're very beautiful. So normally what happens with that type of a fish, you'd shoot one or two, and then you might not shoot another one in your life.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because they're pretty, you know, and their meat is not of value. Unlike a fish like a tuna you would shoot at any size your whole life, because you're going to bring that thing home, and you and all your friends are going to enjoy really good meat. But yeah, so the biggest was, you know, but they also fish in categories. So you might shoot a 5 kilogram fish and it can be a world record, you know. So, but the fish we enjoyed shooting here, there's some quite big cooter. That's a king mackerel, the queen mackerel, the snook. Garrick coming in winter, they're fun. And then you get some grunter that arrive in winter, and some bream that are around through the year.
So generally speaking, throughout the season, you can find something to hunt, and as these things go, if it's for the pot, then so be it. If it's just a sport thing, I think you're quite right. It must be ethically quite difficult to...
So spearfishing gives you the opportunity to be probably amongst, or if not the most, conservation orientated and ethical, because you don't have any bycatch. So nets are obviously the worst. They catch everything, you know, trawlers or anything else, and they take tons and tons and tons. A spear fisherman will take a couple of fish, so the quantity is not there. And then if it's out of season and a fish swims past, you won't shoot it. Whereas if you rock and surf, you may catch it by accident, and the fish could be injured coming in and out. So you choose your fish.
Oh, yeah.
And if you're eating your fish and you're shooting to eat, you don't need many fish. One fish is fine. So that's how I did most of my spear fishing. I would look for something that I hadn't shot before, or something to eat. And
was there ever one that got away? That still comes to you in your dreams?
Well, the funniest one that got away was one day before church. I decided to go for a quick dive, and I got in at Boulder Bay. And we used to do this thing where you clip your car key on the back of your gun because you don't want to hide it because someone might see you hide your key or whatever. And I was diving and this huge queen mackerel came past and I shot it, but it pulled the gun out of my hand. And I chased the fish, but I couldn't find it and it disappeared and had to come in. I didn't have a car key or my phone. I couldn't do anything. So anyway, I was playing drums that weekend at church. Missed playing drums. I had to find Jennifer. She brought me a spare key. So yeah, I wish that one didn't get away because
so somewhere out there, your key is still lodged in the reef. Oh my word! Let's take a musical interlude. We'll come back and chat some more. You've selected a couple of tunes. I've got a Foo Fighters tune.
Yeah, that's
lined
a great song.
What is the story for you for this one? Why did you choose Everlong?
I just more than anything, I really love the song. It's on a couple of surf videos. I enjoy the vibe. I like the guitaring. It's just one of my feel good go-to songs.
Wayne's first choice of song today, the Foo Fighters, the acoustic version of Everlong, which I thought would be appropriate as you're a very fine acoustic player. And I know that. And we've been reminiscing a little bit about the early days and the fishing. Well, certainly this scuba diving and hunting creatures great and small from under the ocean. And you also have a very fine understanding of fishing on top of from the rock and surf. I know that, and of late you've gone back to your roots and have been perfecting the art of catching enormous. I had no idea that carp got to the kind of size that you are targeting, but that must be something quite extraordinary. I know from having also grown up on the Highveld, as it was called back then, that dam fishing requires very different techniques to ocean fishing. Mm. I mean, the ocean fishing, especially if you're rock and surf, you there's always something going on, something going to tap you, and you. Ooh. But in the dam, you can be there all day with nooks,
for days,
which suits a lot of the oaks because then they just hoi. And then you know, it's really an excuse to go down and get away from things and generally get a bit oiled up. For you, no, it's a different matter.
You know, the transition came when you have kids, everything changes. So spearfishing, typically you'd wake up when it's dark, you'd go down to the beach and you dive as long as you can and you come back and you're pretty tired. Even an afternoon dive, tired, you've got to wash all your gear off. Ideally, you want to be able to have a bit of a snooze, but let's just say you're not at your best, you know. And it's totally selfish. It's just you, and it's the ocean, which is what appeals to me, is that sort of escape or being by yourself, being alone in nature. But when you go to a dam and you have kids, the dynamics are wonderful because what happens is every morning you wake up together. You know, it's coffee and a rusk. One kid jumps on a canoe, one's playing in the mud. You know, the kids fish, and then every evening is a braai, and you sit around the dam. And so it's way more family orientated. You can't just be off doing your own thing all the time. So it was great for family, camping together, being out in nature, and I enjoyed the fresh challenge of it. 'Cause at one stage, as you say, I was fishing above water, so I had a long time that spearfishing was the most important. Then I was on a ski boat for a long time, and I actually had used to do private charters. So we would take a couple of people fishing, deep sea fishing, whether they want to fish for tuna, and I did 450 beach launches.
Wow!
So you can imagine
off Salmon Bay.
No, most of it was in the period when we lived in Port Edward because we lived there for a few years. We lived there for about 7 years. We ran a church there. And while I was there, I did that. But I probably did about 100 launches around here before, then a bulk of launches there up and down the coast. And so, I mean, you know, pretty much every fish you can catch, I've caught, big ones, small ones, and everything in between. And something amazing happened in carp fishing. There's a new technique that developed, and people were able to get bigger and bigger fish. And because I grew up in Joburg, I grew up catching carp, but I never caught the big ones. So I got to take on a new challenge, you know, And yeah, so that excited me, a new way to fish,
being with the family. Can you do anything with a carp? I'm talking about table-wise, or is it inedible?
So carp are totally edible. When you find them all over the world, countries like Hungary, they're landlocked, and they have some massive lakes like Lake Balaton, hundreds of kilometers long. They commercially fish for carp, and they will sell it in the supermarkets, and people eat it. In Israel, they have a gefilte fish. It's actually carp. Some of the carp that Jesus' disciples netted, some of those fish were carp.
Okay.
So yeah, people do eat carp, but Dave, it's terrible. It's not because of the bones
or the flavor.
It's bony, yeah. And the flavors. I mean, they just don't taste good at all. You know.
I used to have contact with folk that used to fish for carp in the Vaal, and they used to make a pickled fish that was quite extraordinary.
Yeah.
Because the pickling process creates something, I don't know, the bones dissolve almost. They become like sardines in a tin.
As soon as people tell you it's a great fish to pickle or it makes a good curry, then it's code for it's
an awful
fish. I mean, these Indian ladies could curry a tacky and it would taste nice. You know?
But it goes to show, though, I mean, if you're landlocked and you need protein, and there it is.
People find a way to do it.
So you're not fishing for the pot with those big carp.
No, even more than that, the type of fishing that we do for carp, we are targeting very specifically. There's a way to target them, the older and the bigger fish. And, you know, they're old and they're actually quite rare. So what I enjoy about this way of fishing, it practices fish care. So we have safety rigs that don't harm the fish too much and can be released. They come into a safety net. When we photograph them, they're on a safety mat. We have a fish care thing. If they have cuts and whatever, we treat them and we release them. So all the carp go back to be captured again or to be kept as breeding stock. And I enjoy that in my quite different to spear fishing. But I enjoy that because... everything goes back,
okay,
unharmed, hopefully.
I want to touch on you mentioned family and how important family is and has been and continues to be. You had a tragedy which I don't think many folk would be able to respond to in a manner that you were able to. You lost a son tragically in a car accident, and it affected the entire community.
And the
what touched me deeply was how you went and comforted the driver of the car who was at fault and had taken it terribly personally and as one would and was in a terrible space, and you as a father and a grieving father at that, you went and comforted this kid and in that way, I think, changed his life. What strength did you find? How did you find the strength to cope?
Yeah, thanks, Dave. That's a great topic. It's something I'm happy to chat about. So yeah, the losing Tide was obviously a massive thing for us. And they were coming home one night in the early hours of morning from being out. The car rolled near the Salt Rock Library and is thrown out of the car, sustained some injuries which he didn't recover from, you know. So the driver of the car is a boy I've known since he was very young. I remember teaching him to catch bass at a dam once. He must be 8, 9, 10 years old. And so there were a couple of factors. The one factor is that what happened to Tide, or the driver of the car, I could have been either of those two people so many times in my life. There were many times I was coming home when I was young, you know, in the car from a jaw. There were times that I drove a car, you know, and I'd been drinking, you know, so it's, you know, it's something we shouldn't do, but we did. And so when it happened, you know, caught in this thing of, you know, that could have been me, and it was also a bit unlucky, and you get what you get, you take that risk, this could happen. And so just being real, it was like, you know, from that point of view, I couldn't be too harsh on the driver of the car, because I've done the exact same thing the difference was when I was being silly, I got away with it, you know. That's the one side, yeah.
You are also a man of deep faith, which is you're a pastor of a community of a church, and I'm sure that that must have played a part in your understanding of life and the continuum of where, you know, what happens afterwards, and hopefully, I'm sure that that gave you comfort to a degree to know that your beloved boy would be in a better place for sure. But for me, as a father who had lost a child, you know, one automatically is looking for something to blame because you're just so angry with the world. And the way you handled it was a lesson to, I think, everyone in the community, and a punctuation mark to stop the bus and look at the bigger picture. You know, how did you become a pastor?
Yeah, when I was, I didn't grow up in a Christian home, and I met some Christian guys at. Actually, I went to a youth group to try and get a chick. Her name was Bronwyn. And she told me she was going to the youth group on Friday night. So I thought, hey, here's my chance to snuggle up to Bronwyn.
Sounds familiar.
But I went to youth group but ended up getting what I wasn't after. So yeah, I had some guys and they told me about Jesus and I became a believer. And I was, I really believed it with all my heart, sincerely. And I just grew up like that, and then came time to study. I was going to study either music or to become a pastor. And my parents convinced me to do business first and follow my passions later, which I think is great advice. And it was always something, you know, that was there. And when we were living here, a church started a long time ago. You remember Bayside Church, Mark and Colette Miesk. And Mark sidled up to me and came into the church. And it was a time in my life where I was just, you know, getting on track, and came onto leadership there. And they developed leaders. It seemed that there was a real calling on my life to be a pastor, and they helped me with that and went through our training and did some courses on planting churches and what have you. And then at some stage, it seemed like God was leading us to lead a church in Coastland. And there was a guy, you might know him, Dudley Reed, DJ Reed, who passed away a few years ago. They were leading a church there, and they handed the church to us, and we led that for 7 years, and then came back here. So that's how I became a pastor. Just something that's really in my heart, still in my heart. And
are you leading a church at the moment, or are you kind of freelancing?
So we led that church for 7 years. We came back here for a year, and we've been working. So I'm very comfortable in different roles. So I'm very happy to work, and I'm very happy to be a pastor and lead a church. And really, Dave, it makes no difference to me. It's all the same. I live my life, and then I do what's in front of me, what feels like God's calling me into. And if it's to work, or so that they blend. So when we came here, we were in Ladysmith for a couple of years, and we led a church there. And we came here, and Ryan and Melissa Matthews started a church called Freedom House. But we wanted to come back to the coast, and we thought, if we come back, where should we go? And they're friends of ours, and we knew before they were married. And we knew they would lead a church that we would like. And we thought, well, perfect, we'll just come back and slot in there. So we've been there for 9 years, just in the church, you know, helping out worship team, youth, groups, leadership.
And I saw recently that you're a certified marriage officer.
Yes.
So anyone contemplating getting married,
phone me.
You need to chat to Wayne, because you can handle the whole thing.
I love doing marriages. I've done about 120. It's really handy. So if you guys are out there and maybe you don't go to a church, you don't know how to do the legality, so I can do the registration of the marriage, get you legally married, advise you through that. Do the ceremony if you need someone. So yeah,
I would recommend you in a heartbeat, because I know you do a great job. Let's take another interlude. We've got another tune here.
Go for the Arctic Monkeys.
The Arctic Monkeys.
Yeah.
Oh, you know what? I have an idea that the Arctic Monkeys was the one track that I couldn't. I had to find a substitute. It's an Arctic Monkeys tune.
Oh, that's fine.
But it's a slight
substitute. All of them.
Okay.
Well, all their stuff's good.
Here we go. is Do I Wanna Know? I'm in conversation with Wayne Duncan, old friends of many years chatting together. It's a pleasure. It's such a joy. And before we carry on, I just wanted to backtrack a little bit. We talked in the previous section of our conversation about the fact that you'd lost your beloved son, Tide, and what I had been deeply moved by was your response to the accident, and particularly to those that were involved in the accident, and the driver in particular, who was a friend of your son's and you'd known for years. And instead of harboring animosity and all of those negative things, you chose forgiveness. There was a reason for that you alluded to. Maybe we can just pick that up.
Yeah, thanks, Dave. So this, in terms of spirituality, it's a real thing for me. Like, I understand that they're religions, and I understand that, there are lots of people that have faith. But for me, it's a real thing. It goes deep for me. So when we look at the teachings of Jesus, I mean, he forgave us. You know, the Bible says, while we were still sinners, he forgave us. So we live with that. You know, the only reason I believe I'm going to see Tide is because he's forgiven. The only reason I'm a Christian is because I'm forgiven. So we're meant to forgive other people. And so that, you know, when this all happened, then you're faced with feelings and you have to process those feelings. And Dave, if you don't forgive someone, you become a prisoner of your own unforgiveness. And that person doesn't get free, and you don't get free. So you don't move into the healing of your pain. You don't move on with your life. You get bitterness. You get anger. You get resentment. And, you know, those things build up in you, and they affect your psyche. They affect your relationships. And so you it's just not a good idea. So, you know, we realize this, and we just really ask God to help us the same way we've been forgiven, forgive. And so, yeah, so that's the process that we took. And there was a third component too. It really helped. You know, this community, Belito, were amazing. I mean, you guys, you know, were very supportive. The church we were in, the people, and I mean, the whole town. It's not a church thing. Our friends, Christians and non-Christians, just loved us, supported us, drew near to us. And helped us get through that time. I love this community. Dave, there's a side to this community that's amazing. They're very supportive, very loyal. You know, my business, my customers are loyal.
Yeah.
People stood by us, walked with us. Yeah.
So it's a wonderful,
healing. Yeah.
You know, if there is anything good to come out of a tragedy of that proportion, this is it. You just touched on an interesting point: your customers, your business.
Yeah.
Because you are in business on the North Coast. And,
yeah.
And tell us about that.
During COVID, I lost my company, like many other people would have, and won't get into the details of that. But it was an industry that I'd been in for quite some time, but it became impossible to do during COVID, and I put out my CV, but you know, 6 months went by and we no income coming in. And I had previously in my life run a carpet cleaning company just before I left Joburg. That's how I paid for my studies. I had my first place and my first car and that, and I was like, geez, you know, I need to do something. So I just started cleaning, literally to put food on the table. And then I bought a couple of machines and I just continued doing it, and it just took off. So more and more people started using me. My clients were using me again, and the years have drifted into each other, and we're 4 years down the road and over 1,000 cleans later, and now it's a, you know, it's a healthy business.
What is the company called?
So it's called Duncan Deep Cleaners, and we clean upholstery, we clean carpets, mattresses, curtains, we do scotch guarding, and it's going well. It just started up to feed us, but now the company looks after us. We're able to.
Well, if to you live, you know, the one of well the, in it. One of the things that is, I think, absolute guarantee is if you do a job well, you will succeed. And I know that you're a man of integrity, so I would trust you to to take on the Persian carpet inherited from my great aunt Matilda.
Sue's already asked me to come to your house to deal with the puppy issues. Yeah.
Oh yeah, no, absolutely.
Yeah, so, but to the business guys out there, this I can tell you, this is a good community to be in business. And you can think about anything. Think about a mechanic. Think about a whatever service it is. It's a mission to get someone. But if you get a guy and he phones when you answer, he gives a quote straight away, arrives on time, does a good job, and charges a fair rate. If you've got someone like that, that is a nice guy, hopefully.
Yeah.
Why are you going to change? Why would you change anything?
Well, exactly.
So just do a good job. Look but after your guys
and you
can do well.
Do you know how hard
here.
It is to find guys with that approach in business, in any community? It's a fact. And we took up the challenge a while back to identify the best of the best and then to put them into a directory called Bolito Connect, which you are in.
Yes.
Because you are on our top six of the best of your kind. And it's been an interesting revelation because so many folk have found that it's not easy to find a reliable, dependable, ethical, honest service provider. And they've been... Sometimes people don't start out to go off the rails, but things happen. And eventually, you know, through circumstances, they just can't fulfill the obligations or they have to roll money and it just becomes a nightmare. I sympathize. But ultimately, to find a supplier that delivers, it is a joy. And clearly, that's one of the pillars of your success is that you always have been a man of integrity and a man of his word. So in business, I would imagine just as strong as in life. And it's been an absolute pleasure chatting to you, Wayne.
Yeah, thanks, Dave. Always really, good.
You know, we don't see each other for years, but it's like years haven't
old friends,
intervened. We've just, you know, lovely to catch up again. Thank you so much, Dave.
Thanks for having
me. For coming in, and we'll play out with a tune called Catch and Release, which I think is fairly self-explanatory.
It's the one my wife showed me, and it's a goodie.
Thanks, my very special guest, Wayne Duncan.
Cheers.